You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 9, given in Dornach on the 14th of August, 1921. We have now brought together a few building blocks which should help us erect a kind of edifice, should provide an outlook that will help us delve deeper into the nature of the human being. To progress in the right way, from our considerations of yesterday and the day before, we need today to extend our reflections by looking at the connection between the soul and spirit at work in the human being and the corporeal, material nature, likewise, at work in us. In modern scientific developments, it has grown difficult to bring these things together and establish the interplay between spirit-soul and physical corporeality in any fruitful way. In our era, people are really only aware of a duality. Firstly, the material world, with its workings and configurations, which can then also be found in the human being, and can be studied in fields such as physiology, chemistry, and biology. These things give rise to certain outlooks, which are taken up into general awareness. People cling to them with a certain tenacity, and it must repeatedly be emphasized that even those who still live in older, traditional religious ideas with their, in quotes, Sunday hats on, and actually perhaps these especially, nevertheless entirely acknowledge commonly accepted scientific tenets about the human body. At the same time, there are people who conceive ideas about the spirit and soul, but these are so abstract, are sometimes actually only empty word husks left over from something people were once more familiar with, knowledge of which has been lost, so that nowadays they have little to tell us. While people do speak today of thinking, feeling, and will, while they do speak of thought conceptions, they lack views of these things based on real experience. You might say that mere words have carried on and humanity clings to them, but without being able to make much sense of them. You can see this playing into modern literature about the soul, about psychology and such like, in which references to thinking, feeling, and will are very much empty husks, empty abstractions. Then people notice that on the one hand, they have a view of material things which cannot be denied, since after all they have eyes and hands through which the material world is tangible, visible, and immediate to them, and since they have equipment for weighing and measuring it. So the material world is acknowledged through its direct visibility and sense impressions. On the other hand, people do speak of spirit and soul, but only in the way I just referred to. And they are unable to find a connection, a relationship, between this spirit-soul and the material, physical, or corporeal reality. People have come up with all kinds of theories about how the spirit-soul is meant to interact with material corporeality, but all of them are a tissue of abstraction, a mere spinning of thoughts. You see, before you can gain any insight into these things, you have to be able to encompass the whole human being. If we do so, we discover that in the life between birth and death, no expression of spirit and soul is without a bodily physical expression. If we speak of the physical body and the spirit soul as opposites, this is to speak in the abstract, for they are simply two sides of the same coin. But people do not realize this, and this leads to their difficulty in establishing a theory of how the two principles actually interact with each other. The only thing that helps here is to study this field with a genuinely enhanced, schooled faculty of observation. And in order to do so, we have to draw attention to things that emerge in such observation. It is quite true to say that before exact observation is possible in this field, a person must have undergone a certain schooling, as I described it in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. Nevertheless, once the results of such study are available, when a person knows what has been observed in this field, then they can, if only they so wish, grasp it with their ordinary common sense, as long as they allow themselves to follow carefully the ideas and content which spiritual scientific investigation brings to light. These ideas are, of course, always such that you get nowhere by applying things familiar to you from ordinary science. You have to engage with the ideas actually offered, and healthy common sense is always sufficient to engage with them. However far-fetched and unfamiliar such ideas may seem, whatever unknown worlds they seem to draw from, once they are there, you can engage with them, if you care to. As long as the direct experiences which give rise to them are formulated in comprehensible ideas, you can engage with them. But you have to be willing to grasp ideas, which is something you don't need an esoteric schooling to do. Nevertheless, most people do not seem able to do this nowadays, least of all modern scientists. They are used only to ideas borrowed from the outer sense world, and only at most in mathematics do they allow themselves to grasp ideas that can be traced in their own terms, as mathematical forms can be traced. If you find the will to engage with such ideas, you can follow everything the spiritual scientist presents, and you can also test it in ideal terms. But you have to have the will to do so. And, I have to keep stressing this, no esoteric schooling is needed for this, though you will have to overcome the mode of scientific thinking people nowadays internalize, which is certainly not identical with healthy common sense, since it has cultivated habits of thought that only allow validity to things that correlate with the world of the senses. Today we need to elaborate a number of ideas that can help us progress further with our previous reflections. As our life of thought unfolds, when we picture and think, something, after all, is happening within us. And this is not the abstract process so widely described today, but one in which, certainly, lives what people call material processes. To trace the material effects of mental or spiritual processes does not make us materialists. We only become materialists if we deny the spirit through preconceptions or prejudice. As soon as we fully realize what is actually happening in the soul or psyche when we think, when we picture, then gradually, without any esoteric schooling, we can arrive at an inward grasp of the soul-body process at work there. And this soul-body process in thinking, in thought, is one whose soul properties show it to be the opposite of another process. Try to survey the scope of ordinary consciousness to discover what process is the opposite of thinking. It is the one where thoughts vanish, where we become unable to follow thoughts in a clear fashion, where, therefore, what we ordinarily call conscious comes to an end, or at least where our power ceases to hold sway over what we call conscious in ordinary life. Now, you can find a bodily correlate for this counter-image of thinking. Wherever the growth process, the developmental process, the nutritional or growth process appears especially strongly, the element of thought and thinking withdraws. You need only observe the lively organic growth activity at work in early infancy. Here we can see growth activity in an especially vivid form. But as yet thinking is only germinally present, or at least the power a person has over their thinking. Or observe processes of illness, in which, as in febrile conditions, organic activity becomes particularly vehement, where it is intensified. And then you will see that conscious power over the life of thought fades away. Thus we see a contrast, one we could continue to describe in ever more detailed fashion. But at present I want only to give guidelines. On the one hand, our life of thought, which initially we understand in psychological terms, and on the other, the life of growth. To point more clearly to what is actually at work, I will here write proliferative growth, which highlights the contrast in more corporeal form. But try for a moment to go further from this point of departure. Recall how I have often said that in the ordinary mind, it is only in thought that we have this bright, clear, waking consciousness that we carry through the day, from the moment of awakening to that of falling asleep. What, on the other hand, is at work in us when we develop a will impulse, is submerged in an element as dark and obscure as that we entered during sleep. We are not only asleep between the time of falling asleep and waking up again, but in the waking state, too, we are partly asleep. Asleep as far as our will activity is concerned. Everything that lives in us as will activity is wrapped in a condition of sleep. We know, whenever we intend to raise our hand, for example, what intention instigates this, what motive. But in relation to what actually occurs when we lift a hand, when our will, therefore, is at work, we are as much asleep as we are when asleep. So, what happens here, really? What is going on? It is this. The organic foundation of the will must be sought below in processes of growth of which we remain unconscious. The will is submerged in growth processes. All that proliferates in us as growth at the same time possesses an affinity with the will, is seen in outward bodily terms a process of growth, and seen in terms of the inner soul is will. And so we can discover that proliferative growth, like everything encompassed in the energy streams that come to expression in growth, in nutrition, in life altogether, as an affinity with the will. So if we observe this in terms of the soul or psyche, we can say that it is connected with the will. Now when we consider human life between birth and death, it is certainly true to say that what we call our will is an abstraction, relative to each and every act or activity. This will of ours does not unfold in isolation. Always there is a metabolic process, or growth process, or a nutritional or denutritional process, at work within which the will unfolds. To a lesser extent, we find present here something that in the case of an especially intensified growth or life process, extinguishes consciousness. This is why our consciousness in the will realm is also extinguished. This will region in us exists in the same realm as proliferative growth, and therefore it lies in the unconscious. As human beings, therefore, we must distinguish within us a realm, and of course I'm drawing this schematically, where proliferative growth occurs. Within this proliferative realm of growth, which does not surface into conscious awareness, the will is rooted. But in our tangible reality, this is all one, really. Only in thinking do we separate the will out from this proliferative growth. Another realm, which we have initially only considered in terms of the psyche, is one that comprises our thinking. This thinking, conceiving, picturing, develops either in relation to outward thoughts or by virtue of the memory process translating itself into thoughts or pictures whenever we remember past experiences. Now, in psychological terms, we can very clearly see why this life of thought is the opposite of will life, and also the opposite of living growth, of the life of the organism altogether, their counterpole. This life of thinking, conceiving, picturing exists in exemplary form where we have ourselves fully in hand, where we link one thought to the next in sequence, where we analyze thoughts and combine them. We can see thinking in contrast to will. By its very nature, the will is unconscious for us. We now know that we are unconscious of it because it is rooted in growth, in living processes, in metabolic processes. Thinking is the polar opposite to will. We have it in our power. But the moment the spiritual investigator advances into the realm of imagination, it immediately becomes clear what is actually present in thinking. Picture to yourself very precisely for a moment this process we undergo when we progress from ordinary thinking to imagination. Ordinary thinking is abstract. When a person thinks, they are only aware of this life of thought. But when, through methods I have described in title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, this thinking concentrates itself into imaginative life, then the pictures inherent in this life arise. It is, after all, understandable that nothing which occurs in the soul, that is, which is experienced there, does not also have some kind of correlate in ordinary life between birth and death. We perceive something in ourselves when we ascend to imagination. And what we perceive is, in fact, the very process that occurs in all thinking. For imaginative cognition is only a further development of it. As I said, human realities do not become any different when we ascend to higher supersensible cognition. It is just that we learn to perceive things that are always anyway present. What we now learn to perceive is always happening, but we are unaware of it in our ordinary mind. But if now in a higher consciousness we perceive the pictures that attend it, then we know that such pictures correspond in the human organization to certain configurations of deposits, really material deposits. These deposits of actual substances are always present in us, but we do not observe them. You see, what we experience in imagination are not new deposits. Rather, imagination enables us to discern deposited substances that are always there. We would be unable to have imaginative pictures at all if we did not specifically see, though it can scarcely be called seeing, these deposits, or become aware of them, since the pictures of imagination are reflected in and by them. Then we notice that such deposits are also certainly present in ordinary thinking. They are connected with the subtle organization of our nervous system and all that belongs to it. They constitute the nervous system. The life of our nervous system depends upon these deposits. As I said, they remain unknown to the ordinary mind, but can be discerned with imaginative consciousness. Thus concludes a sequence of considerations that we can sum up as follows. The life of thought is opposite to that of will. But the will is bound up, as we can see from considerations such as I have presented, to proliferative growth. Now we can discern that in this case the life of thought is bound up with the opposite of proliferative growth, thus with dying off, dying away. And in truth, what unfolds in us here, which imaginative cognition can inwardly behold, is how organic material substance falls away from the process of proliferative growth. So we find, certainly, that the process of proliferative growth, thus of metabolism, lives in us, and that dying matter continually lapses from it. as we think we are continually being filled with this dying matter. We discern this dying of matter whenever we ascend to imagination. And our thinking, conceiving, and picturing is bound up with this dying matter. It is true to say that we human beings bear the metabolic process within us, the dissolution and amalgamation of substances, and so forth. That will life lives within this, and that matter continually inwardly dies and excretes the parts of it that are no longer involved in metabolism's organizing powers. Non-organic substances continually lapse from organic life, and our life of thought is bound up with their falling away. Thus, if the growth process, the metabolic process, becomes too rampant, our life of thought vanishes. If the dying process becomes too dominant, then our thoughts become ever more rigid and pedantic. It is not easy for someone without esoteric schooling to succeed in beholding these things within them, and this is scarcely something we can expect or require. But on the other hand, it is possible for them to arrive at the insight that any moment when we lose consciousness, if only when we fall asleep, then this represents a victory of the powers of growth and metabolism over the other powers that underlie the inner activity responsible for our thoughts. And with enough open-mindedness to examine oneself in this way, it is likewise possible to perceive how an inner tiring, how a sinking away from matter, occurs within us as we elaborate thoughts, as we live ever more consciously in our life of thought. We bear birth and death continually within us, and the principle that stands at the beginning of life and is called birth, when growth forces are liveliest and most active, and consciousness has for the time being greatly dwindled, works on in us right up to death, and is basically the bearer of our will, our unconscious will, that only becomes conscious for us by shining the light of thought into it. The proliferative life there is permeated by continual processes of dissolution, by a process of dying, by a continual occurrence of something that is finally concentrated into one at the moment of death. And just as the proliferative growth process outwardly manifests the will element, so the inward dying process manifests the element of thought, conceiving, picturing. Ultimately, when we know how to cultivate this perception in us, we arrive at the knowledge that in fact we are continually being born and continually dying, and that the unique event of being born at the beginning of an earthly life is nothing other than a summation of what continues in miniature through our whole life until we die. In mathematical terms, we might say that actual birth is an integer of all the birth differentials active throughout life. Similarly, the differentials of death are active in us, and actual death is only an integer of them. In other words, we are continually, inwardly dying in a way that keeps postponing death, keeps canceling death at the moment it would come about. Then, this is the material foundation for our life of thought. And when death comes, and thus when something that is continually at work in us grows more intensive and bursts its bonds, then the moment of death has arrived. In the same way, at actual birth, something is immeasurably intensified in us that throughout life is continually at work in processes of growth. And so we behold the unity of the soul spiritual and bodily material process. And without this, we cannot arrive at any real spiritual knowledge. Now, at a certain point of our life, we are always very close to the point of accomplishing a transition between the thinking that must fill our conscious awareness in waking life and the proliferative element that continually seeks to extinguish thinking. This is the moment when we fall asleep. We could put it like this. we arrive here at a maximum of proliferative growth, and this is, for the time being, to be accounted to the life principle. This is something that becomes very familiar to anyone who advances to imaginative perception. You see, at the moment imaginative perception arises, we also become able to have experiences we sleep through in ordinary life, ones where ordinary consciousness is extinguished because it is overwhelmed by the will growth principle. This is also the process that surfaces in hallucinations, and in a certain respect also when people live in illusions or visions. Visions are pathological occurrences. We can understand them, let's say, in soul-body terms. If we see a certain unity between the will and the proliferative growth principle, which then seizes hold and to a degree pulls apart what ought to be being consolidated in the death process. This puts a stop to the developing corpse we are continually becoming. Something is torn from us and proliferates that ought to be dying in us if we are healthy. These are unleashed thought bundles that we only understand them to be so if we see the harmony between the material body and our soul and spirit. Whenever someone has visions or hallucinations, growth forces are always proliferating and becoming rampant in them. You come to perceive certain preparatory schoolings for the imaginative realm, and if these preparatory schoolings are undertaken in the right way, a person becomes able to live their way consciously into what is continually occurring in life's daily reality. That is, we really find our way through dream thoughts into the full state of sleep. If we advance into imagination, we learn to find our way into this condition in which ordinary consciousness is removed from us. In other words, we come to a place where the process of dying is actually overcome in a certain way. In daily life, it is overcome in the state of sleep. But in higher knowledge, we are led into a like state, albeit then a conscious one. And when someone, in this way, gets beyond their ordinary consciousness, they learn to perceive that their ordinary consciousness cannot access this state. In ordinary consciousness, a person departs from their physical and etheric bodies by falling asleep, whereas in imaginative cognition, we depart from them while still awake. But the realm we first enter by doing so, that is, the first realm we enter, as we enter this world of spirit that opens through imagination, is one we initially experience as being a space of absolute emptiness and darkness. We cannot actually enter the world of spirit without taking this detour through dark emptiness. But this is what lies beyond the boundary of our sense perception. If you recall the schematic sketch I drew yesterday on the board, sense impressions that, you can say, are transmitted to us and are waves upon which the eye, capital, moves, you will see how the eye goes out into the surrounding world in which it actually also otherwise lives. But in the waking life, it extends its feelers into the body. Now, however, it draws back from the body and, along with the parts that have become accustomed to accompanying bodily life, it arrives out in the world that lies beyond our senses. It becomes acquainted with the realm of spirit. It does not become acquainted with atoms, but with the world of spirit beyond the senses. But first it has to pass through absolute dark emptiness, out of which alone the spiritual realm is born for it. You have here one boundary, the one which human experience borders on, or which human experience has as it encounters the world. This boundary has to be there. If it were not, we would not be as if sundered from our surroundings by a yawning abyss. We could never develop true love, for this requires us to be able to acquaint ourselves with emptiness all around us. If we filled everything around us, we could never flow into the other with our being. which is precisely what comes about in the true nature of love. If we wish to come to know the nature of love through a real process of knowledge, then we have to know that when feelings of love develop in us, we actually extend ourselves into the realm where our consciousness is empty. It is only thus that we can fill ourselves with something other than ourselves. The development of love is precisely the offering of this emptiness of consciousness to the other. Who then fills it? But if the right harmony does not exist between the spirit soul and physical bodily nature, and you will notice that this is only a rough expression that does not fully encompass the reality, for we speak here of harmony, as we do in relation to a harmony of other processes, but nevertheless, this way of putting it suffices, so that either the spirit soul or physical bodily nature has too great a preponderance, and thus the two aspects do not come to complete expression, then something pathological occurs. In one direction, it is pathological if someone infuses their own being into the realm that should be emptiness for them. Then they inform this emptiness with the world of their visions and hallucinations. A true esoteric schooling is precisely what overcomes such hallucinations and visions. We cannot sufficiently emphasize that these are pathological. And what esoteric schooling develops is the unfolding of powers that are the opposite of those which give rise to hallucinations or visions. In hallucination or vision, a person develops powers the opposite of those that must be counseled for imaginative life. Repeatedly one finds there are people who do not necessarily have to be particularly unwell, who are not, therefore, hallucinating, but who do see visions. Actually, a great many people pass through life with visions. They are proud of it, believing that their visions disclose spiritual realities to them. But in fact, this signifies only the proliferation of their life forces, the spilling over of these into the emptiness. There are also some who become arrogant, who have delusions of grandeur, in that they say they have undergone initiation, whereas in fact what they are experiencing is growth forces abnormally over-proliferating in their thinking. And when such people approach exercises that must be seriously advised to develop imagination, sometimes something very strange happens. Such people then say, "Yes, I have now lost my capacity for spiritual vision." What they have lost, in fact, are their involuntary visions. And this is because these exercises for developing true imagination, which they practice, counteract their pathological, in quotes, seership. People who in this way believe they are living by natural powers in the world of spirit are living in it in a morbid way, and usually they then lose what has become so clear to them in an arrogant kind of self-love. Repeatedly, we can find how visionary powers are pathological in nature, and how what we strive for in imaginative beholding are the opposite of them, our health-bringing powers. From this we see that as we progress beyond sense perception, human experience finds a realm that can only be objectively encompassed in imaginative life. In involuntary visions, we merely shine our own existence into the emptiness. But if, instead, we experience the emptiness, then into it, in the same way that the outer world impinges upon our senses, comes what I have already described as the weaving, actively working world of the hierarchy of Angeloi. This active, living world of the Angeloi hierarchy works all around us. But now, in the other direction, we can also, however, find a realm bordering on human experience which lies beyond thinking in a more inward domain. We can say that this perception is connected with the I, capital. Now, we enter it with the astral body. We have thinking. Now, we descend into the etheric body. we have the activity of memory. And in the physical body, pictures. Ordinary consciousness does not reach down here into the etheric body, and nor does it emerge here. Out there lies the world which must be said to be that of the living, weaving Angeloi. Thus it is a world of spirit existing above our world of consciousness. It does not lie outside the field of human life, but it does lie outside of ordinary awareness. Our eye, you see, which we expressly said lies outside the field of sense impressions and brings these inward, is very much connected with this world. It is the world which we can only enter with strengthened awareness, since otherwise our awareness is diminished, and we succumb to loss of consciousness. Each time we fall asleep, we succumb to this unconsciousness, and in doing so ascend into this world. So that is what happens when, going beyond sense perception, we reach out into this realm. But now, in the other direction, we can also descend into our own being. This happens whenever the destructive forces of death within us take a stronger hold on us than usual, or, more accurately, when they become conscious to us. In the same way that we can extend ourselves outward beyond the boundary of sense life, so through what I call esoteric schooling, we can delve downward. But what we experience there, if it is not to appear in a somewhat pathological form, certainly has to remain inward. We must not allow it to surface into our ordinary consciousness. We must leave this realm below, where it is otherwise unconscious. This means that we must not allow this realm, which lies in the etheric body, to stream up into our ordinary consciousness, but instead we must guide our ordinary consciousness down into the etheric body. Thus what lies below must not surface into ordinary thought. Rather, ordinary thought must delve down to it. From this we can see, though, that we are dealing with a realm which, just like the other I described, in a sense surrounds the human physical body and is always present within it. It belongs to entities dwelling within us, to which we have often pointed in spiritual scientific contexts. References to this realm are such that those who have discerned it, who have beheld something of it, will say that it is impossible to express in human words what lies there below. You can trace this in accounts from ancient Egyptian initiations through to Edward Bulwer Lytton. But we can hint at it, in a way, and we do actually need to speak about this realm, for within it is rooted everything in the life of the human soul and body that must not really unfold in our outward demeanor. What is rooted there is human evil. Something very remarkable becomes apparent here. This source of evil is actually always present in us. We must never for a moment succumb to the illusion that we do not harbor the source of evil within us. It lies, if you like, below the level of our life of thought. And it must certainly not infect this life of thought, for otherwise thoughts become impulses for evil. It must remain below. And anyone who wishes to behold it must be so morally strong that they do not allow it to rise up into awareness, but really only send their awareness down into it. But now you might wonder why this realm lies within us. Well, that's like asking why the plant does not stop growing once it has put forth green leaves. It goes on growing by its own vigor. We bear within us the dying process which develops our thinking. This process is still conscious, but it must descend into the unconscious realm. If it did not continue, our thoughts would never consolidate to enable memory to come about in us, so that later thoughts can surface in us through experiences we have had in thinking. Thus the dying process has to continue in order for us to summon a memory. and the being to whom we owe the faculty of memory is the same who appears in the wrong way whenever impulses for evil appear in us. In a sense, the proclivity to evil in some people is, forgive me for using this expression, a spirit-soul hiccup of what ought to remain below and ensure that we can remember. This power of memory is rooted in us, and just as a bodily hiccup exists, so also this spirit-soul hiccup. Whenever what is assigned us in divine wisdom in the depths of our being, as the power of memory, hiccups into consciousness, in the same way that something, forgive this rather unappetizing expression, burps up in a bodily way, then you have a tendency to criminality. There is nothing in the world which is not justified in its proper domain, but that cannot cause mischief if displaced. If anything in the world appears to us as if it should not exist, we have to ask where ought it to be to fulfill its proper task. And here, as we descend into this realm, we arrive in another, that of the hierarchy of the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. In the same way that, progressing beyond the realm of the senses, we emerge into the weaving world of the angeloi, archangeloi, and archai. We descend here into a realm where we now clearly see how the natural power connected with our memories also has a moral aspect to it. Just consider what this means. Spiritual science discovers such a thing, a natural process which has a moral aspect, that is, where something displaced acquires a moral character. The ailment of our time is precisely that moral religious life has become abstract on the one hand, by contrast to natural causality on the other. People fail to discern the method for bringing these two together. Here you have a quite specific process where a natural endowment bears within it something that can become the opposite of moral, can give rise to immorality. But don't you see something strange here? If we consider how something gets out of hand in one direction, then in a sense we arrive below our conscious mind in an anti-morality, which we need for the sake of our faculty of memory. But in going beyond sense impressions, we arrive in the realm of love, as I said, which is fundamentally the power of morality. We enter the domain of morality. We thus become better and better able to build a bridge between the world of religion and morality on the one hand, and the physical bodily world, the world of natural causality, on the other. This is a bridge that has to be built. And whenever we either emerge into spirit or descend into spirit, we actually arrive in the world of the hierarchies. You can say, therefore, that we can touch into the realm of the hierarchies from two directions. Our reflections can, of course, only unfold by circling round our goal. We cannot approach it as one would in mathematics by starting from elementary concepts and building up to greater complexity, but rather by circling round what it is that we ultimately seek to understand. The end of Lecture 9.